the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking today about New Orleans, rebuilding the city, rebuilding it neighborhood by neighborhood. What does it mean? What will the new New Orleans look like? With us is my guest today in the studios, Dr. Charles S. Kelly, Jr. Chuck Kelly is president of the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. We've talked a lot about that seminary in terms of what it experienced in the aftermath of the hurricane and how it can be a real launching pad, a real foundation for helping to rebuild New Orleans in terms of Christian activism, Christian activity, and the Christian churchmanship. We'll be talking with Dr. Kelly and with you in the second segment. First, a review of issues in the news. Of course, all eyes were on Washington, D.C. in the Oval Office this morning when President George W. Bush made his nomination of Harriet E. Myers to be the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. A lot of Americans came to know Harriet Myers just this morning. She has been the White House counsel since earlier this year. Since 2001, she has been a special assistant to the president. She is a 1970 law graduate of Southern Methodist University. And prior to the president's election, Harriet Myers was his personal attorney. And so what we have here is a president who has made a nomination based not so much on a jurist of a well-known national stature, but instead of an attorney that obviously has his confidence. Let's listen to the president this morning as he made the nomination.
In selecting a nominee, I sought to find an American of grace, judgment, and unwavering devotion to the Constitution and laws of our country. Harriet Myers is just such a person. I've known Harriet for more than a decade. I know her heart. I know her character.
That was President George W. Bush. And what was particularly important from that segment of the president's speech that we heard just a moment ago is his recollection, his affirmation of the fact that his confidence in Harriet Myers is based in his personal relationship with her, a professional relationship based on the fact that she was his attorney, has been active in his administration as an official ever since 2001. And when the president said, I've known Harriet for more than a decade, I know her heart, I know her character, he was really speaking of that personal connection. And that's why an awful lot of Americans are kind of scratching their head trying to figure all this out. In other words, who is Harriet Myers? We do not have that relationship. We have not observed her closely. She does not have the kind of track record that other nominees might have had for this high office. And so what you will see when you look around the blogosphere, listen to the news media, and as you observe the talking head programs, you're going to see that there's an awful lot of conjecture, speculation. Perhaps even some armchair quarterbacking and evaluation of the president's pick. Here's the bottom line right now. This is Monday, the very day the president made his nomination. We're dealing with a nomination that is merely hours old, and there is much to be known. And so intelligent Christians will want to be very much alert, very interested, and we'll be wanting to watch very carefully the kind of response that we hear to this nomination. Interesting already. It's going to get more interesting, I can guarantee you. And we'll be learning a whole lot more about Harriet Myers, not only in these days immediately ahead, but also in the hearings that will begin in the Senate Judiciary Committee in coming weeks. Folks, last week I talked about this article published in the Times of London, supposedly arguing that high rates of Christian belief lead to high rates of social pathologies. Ruth Gledhill, writing in the Times of London, was basing her article on a research report by Gregory S. Paul that had been published in the Journal of Religion and Society. And last week, I raised the issue of how statistics can be so misused. To give an example, as I said, the fact that that steel prices may be increasing, well, that would be interesting, but that doesn't explain why retirees would be eating more broccoli. But you wouldn't know that when you see the way the press often deals with statistics. You have a confusion between what the statisticians call correlation and causation. In other words, the very fact that certain figures are correlated with each other doesn't mean that one explains the other, or for that matter, even has anything to do with it. And so last week we simply looked at this article and we mourned the fact that there are secularists who are so intent on hating Christianity that they will try to use this kind of statistic. And so, well, we consigned this article to the kind of confusion we often find in the press, but you will not be surprised to know there's much more to this story. And if you go to my weblog at albertmohler.com, you'll find a major story because investigation has revealed that this article has a much seamier side than had been first expected. It turns out that Gregory S. Paul is not even identified within the Journal of Religion and Society. And by the way, that is an academic journal published by Creighton University. But it turns out that they don't even know who this man is. That's right. An academic journal accepted this article from a man whose identity is unknown even to the editors of the journal. And it turns out, upon investigation, that he's not even a statistician. He's a paleontologist. He's a dinosaur expert. His published work prior to this has been primarily illustrated works about theropod dinosaurs. There's something else to this. He is also a speaker for the Council for Secular Humanism. That is one of the most organized secularist groups opposed to Christianity in every shape and form. And on their recommended speakers bureau list, he is listed as a specialist in opposing creation, the doctrine of creation, and movements such as intelligent design. And that explains a great deal. Samuel Gilbreth, who is a Canadian statistician, explains it this way. He says, what can be pulled together from all of this? Gregory Paul has published a study of social problems and religious faith, but he has no apparent expertise or qualifications in social science research. So predictably, this study is statistically invalid. Said study was published by a journal that apparently does not have high standards for articles it publishes and does not even know how to contact Mr. Paul. Finally, said study makes a ham-handed attempt to portray religious faith as a dangerous and socially destructive force in the U.S., and it transpires that the author is on the Council for Secular Humanism's list of recommended speakers. Mr. Gilbert said, I think that Mr. Paul has successfully played a big con game. He must be admired for that, at least. I responded, well, I guess if such an accomplishment deserves admiration, Mr. Paul should be admired. We are indebted to Scott Gilbert for his tenacious research, and this gives us a real wake-up call. We need to be very, very careful with statistics. We need to be careful when statistics are used in arguments against us, and folks, intellectual credibility, intellectual integrity demands that we be even more careful when we use statistics to bolster our own arguments. Statistics can tell us everything, something, or nothing. But all too often in the press, they tell us more nothing than something. And this is another indication of why we must watch. And this means that when we see articles that that are based on this kind of research, we need to look with a very critical eye. I'm hoping that readers of the Los Angeles Times are looking with a very critical eye, because Rosa Brooks has published an op-ed in Sunday's edition of that newspaper in which she takes the very same study and she even pushes Ruth Gledhill's argument a few steps farther. She says this, although correlation is not causation, Gregory Paul's study offers much food for thought. At a minimum, his findings suggest that contrary to popular belief, lack of religiosity does societies no particular harm. This should offer ammunition to those who would maintain that religious belief is purely private and that government should remain neutral, not only among religions, but also between religion and lack of religion. It should also give a boost to critics of faith-based social services and abstinence-only disease and pregnancy prevention programs. Now, just let me interrupt myself. Do you notice the non sequiturs here? How in the world do you get from A to B? How in the world do you get from those statistics to opposition to abstinence-only sex education? But she's not finished. I'm back to her article here. She says, we shouldn't shy away from the possibility that too much religiosity may be socially dangerous. Secular, rationalist approaches to problem-solving emphasize uncertainty, evidence, and perpetual reevaluation. Listen to her last sentence. Religious faith is inherently non-rational. Well, not my faith. My faith is not rationalism, but it is certainly not inherently non-rational. The truth claims that constitute the Christian faith, they are not non-rational. They demand belief. Christianity presents a comprehensive, cogent, and very powerful worldview, a total understanding of truth that is extremely rational, because the Christian faith dignifies our brain, our consciousness, our intellect. It's a part of what it means to be made in the image of God. I don't know what it says that a major American newspaper would publish such an article, but it does tell us that we need to be very careful when we look at these kinds of reports in the press. We need to look at what's underneath. Meanwhile, we have been following for months now the story of expanding euthanasia in the Netherlands, and you won't be surprised that yesterday MSNBC reports that the Dutch government intends to set guidelines for the killing of babies. You'll remember last year we talked about the development of the Groningen protocols. Doctors at the Groningen Academic Hospital in the Netherlands who were asking for permission to euthanize newborns even as they were admitting that they were already doing so. Now the Dutch policy comes even as the Dutch government says that it believes this is a rational expansion of euthanasia. Folks, the next time someone tells you that the slippery slope argument is wrong, just point them to the Netherlands. The line between what is called voluntary and involuntary euthanasia in the Netherlands is getting very faint indeed. We should ask this question. After euthanizing babies, who's next? How do you rebuild a city that has been devastated by water and abandoned by the majority of its citizens? The city of New Orleans is going to become a great social laboratory for America, and we have with us a guest who can tell us what it was like to be there and what it's like to be a part of the solution. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. New Orleans, Louisiana. It's been a tourist destination, a city famed not only as a port but as an entertainment center, a city known for its culture, given to the pursuits of the flesh and entertainment and gambling and so many other things. And Laissez de bon temps rouler, I think, is my rendition of Let the Good Times Roll, which has kind of been the expression of the city of New Orleans, known as the Big Easy. Right now, it's an abandoned wreck of a city. It is the most significant major evacuation of an American city in our nation's history. It is the greatest natural disaster, Hurricane Katrina, in our nation's history. And we're learning a whole lot about community. We're learning a whole lot about what it takes to create a city and to sustain a city. We saw in the aftermath of Katrina all kinds of really mayhem and anarchy, and we saw, as we said, what happens when the restraining grace of law and order are removed, and then we saw the physical destruction. And one of the big questions on the minds of many Christians is, how should we think about this? How do we think about, as Christians, responding to the challenge of rebuilding a city like that? With me in the studio today, I'm glad to have my colleague and close friend, Dr. Chuck Kelly, who is president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. And that great institution is located right in the city of New Orleans. Chuck, it's great to have you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mueller. Delighted to be with you.
Now, Chuck, you and Rhonda, your dear wife, you basically got out just as the storm was coming in.
We were among the last people to leave the city. It's the first time I've ever left for a storm, but because of the circumstances, we felt we had to in case we were cut off from communication. It took us 4 hours to drive the 30 miles across the lake and into the next community because the traffic was so heavy leaving town.
Now, I've not asked you this question before, but, you know, my guess is that even as you left, you had no idea what this hurricane was going to be.
No, we've done this so many times before, and that's the background of it. I couldn't count up the number of times that we've had the many people leave the city of New Orleans for hurricanes coming close to us before, even for hurricanes coming through the city before. So it's a common drill that we've done before, but it turned out to be something on a scale no one had ever imagined.
Now, I can't imagine what it was like as the president of an institution to watch the reports. You know, tell us what was going on in your heart and in your head.
Well, as we were driving up, we heard all the dire forecasts. It took us about 13 hours to drive from the city to Birmingham that first night. And driving up, everybody predicted a disaster. And then about midnight, they said the hurricane had moved a little to the right and we'd be spared a direct hit. The next afternoon, the hurricane had completely passed, and it looked like we had just been brushed. Our campus and city had some damage, lots of wind, some flooding, but not very much at all. And then it was the night after the storm had passed, under a clear blue sky, when the levee broke and everything changed.
And well, tell us what changed.
What changed was that 80% of the city fell underwater, and all of a sudden, New Orleans, as we knew it, no longer existed. So many people were in danger of life. They pulled the police and other rescue personnel into just strictly search and rescue. They stopped all kinds of patrols and law enforcement as they turned to the rescue operation, and the city grew out of control. The people that were left were predominantly the poor and impoverished of New Orleans, and it just descended into chaos, even civic leaders having a difficult time grasping how big the chaos was.
You know, Chuck, there are all kinds of political autopsies being done right now. Whose fault was what? Why didn't things happen? I'm going to leave that for somebody else. But I want us to go to the question, where were the Christians in the middle of all this?
Gone. What you find out, Dr. Mueller, is that when you use every form of media that exists and for 48 hours you tell everybody to leave and you tell them if you stay, you're probably going to die. And you hammer it over 24 hours a day for 48 hours, every form of media. What happens is that just about everybody leaves. And what you have left, you have about 15% of the people who are left are the hardheads who are not going to leave under any circumstances, and about 85% of the people who are left are the poor who have no place to go. And so what happened is that all community leaders, all civic organizations, pastors, everybody was gone but the poor.
We're going to really talk about that because I think America's conscience is still reeling from the scenes of what happened, and also from the recognition that we obviously were as a nation unprepared for this. And I think most of us still don't know what being prepared would look like. It just wouldn't look like that. But I want to go back to the storm itself for just a moment. You and I are two of the very rare academic presidents in America who get to serve the institutions from which we ourselves graduated. And so your experience at New Orleans Seminary goes back how long?
30 years. I've been there 30 consecutive years.
Yeah, well, you just think about that. That's three decades, the majority of your life. And so I know what must have been going through your heart, but let's just talk about the toll in terms just within your community at first, right within the seminary, of faculty and students. What in the world happened to them?
The very hard thing is that about 90% of our academic and administrative space was virtually untouched, a relatively minor damage. But we took a huge hit in the personal area of the campus, the living quarters. 100% of our faculty who lived on campus had major flooding in their homes and lost virtually everything they had. About 45% of our student housing was flooded, and those students lost virtually everything that they had.
And the others can't get to their homes.
It has been more than a month and a week since the storm moved in, and we will get to our homes for the first time on Wednesday of this week.
I think most Americans can't really fathom that. It's very hard to get our minds around something like that. And, Chuck, I just think as a churchman, as a Christian, looking at that area, I mean, you literally have entire churches that have disappeared, not so much the buildings, but the members.
Well, you really learn that the essence of a church is its people and not its structure, because that's exactly what happened. One of my pastor friends had more than 5,000 people gathered on Sunday morning before the storm hit. And the day after the storm hit, he could not tell you where 200 of those people were. And it's not just that they're out of town for the weekend, it's that they have relocated all over the United States. More than 1 million people have left the greater New Orleans area. They're in all 50 states of the United States, scattered out everywhere, and no one knows how many of those will come back. They're enrolled their children in school. They certainly won't be back anytime soon. It's just a completely vacant, empty city.
Now, I think the two questions we need to focus on are these. Number one, why did this happen? Not the natural disaster, but the human disaster. Why did it happen that you had all these poor persons who were basically helpless there in the inner city of New Orleans, in the Superdome and elsewhere, the Civic Center? And secondly, how do we even think about rebuilding a civilization where a sizable and very significant city had once been? These are questions that can hardly be just passed off to the politicians. Certainly the economists and the sociologists and the criminologists and everyone else will have their say. But what we're about here is a distinctively Christian way of thinking. How do we as Christians, biblically, in terms of the Christian gospel, understand how to think about the rebuilding of a city? You know, architects and engineers will worry about building the buildings. And all the people that worry about sewers and roads and electricity grids and all the rest, they'll be doing their work. But I'm really concerned about those churches. Where will the body of Christ be visible in local congregations that will be lighthouses for the gospel, lighthouses for the transforming gospel of Jesus Christ, for the only message that saves, and quite frankly, lighthouses for rebuilding a community, individual by individual and family by family? My guest today in the studio is Dr. Chuck Kelly, president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. You have the opportunity today by calling this program to ask someone who has been through this experience what it means and to offer how you think Christians ought to address this issue. The future of New Orleans is the issue. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK, coast to coast. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My guest today, Dr. Chuck Kelly, president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, kind of ground zero right now in terms of what's happening in New Orleans. Dr. Kelly said that kind of the lead group of people who will be returning to that campus will be there next Wednesday. A lot of work to do, but not only on that campus, in the entire city of New Orleans. Let's go back to the immediate aftermath of the storm, after the levees broke, and when there were so many people crowding into the Civic Center and the Superdome in downtown New Orleans. Chuck, you know, kind of take us there. Who were these people, and how did they get there?
About 100,000 people in New Orleans have no transportation but public transportation. About 100,000 people in New Orleans are living at or below the poverty line. And they had no evacuation plan at all for those people. No way to get them out of the city, no way to disperse them to different places. And the only plan was to open up the Superdome and let them come in. And basically they were to bring their own food, bring their own water, bring their own bedding. It was not set up as a traditional shelter. And what happened was people could come to the Superdome, but they couldn't go anywhere else. And once the flooding came, they couldn't even get out of the Superdome. And so you had all these people who had nowhere to go and no resources and nothing to do, and the sheer volume overcame whatever infrastructure was left.
Now, assuming that it could have happened otherwise, what should have happened in New Orleans? And in other words, not only logistically, but as a community, how should have the community responded differently and its leaders?
Well, first of all, there should have been a plan to evacuate people who had no means of transportation. That's number one. Number two, they should have pre-positioned resources to be able to come in immediately after the storm passed, to be able to bring in things like food and water and to have additional help for security and so forth. And then number three, there should have been some thought given to what do you do if you can't use streets and so forth for more than 24 hours to 48 hours. And there had never been any thought, because every time we've done this in the past, the city basically shuts down for about 24 to 48 hours, and then it's pretty much back to normal.
Right. I think one of the sobering realizations that has come to me trying to get my mind around this problem is the fact with that many people, you're really talking about a mobilization of resources and things that would take days, not hours. And Mayor Nagin declared a state of emergency and evacuation something like 21 hours before the storm hit. I think one of the lessons from this, and I'm not even looking at the political side of this, just in the human equation, it would take days, really, to evacuate. It would take a much faster process, but still, it would take more time than we really had here.
Well, and that's the problem. You have two problems: the frequency with which hurricanes threaten the Gulf, and then the realities of what it takes to get people out. It takes about 48 hours, generally, to evacuate most of the population. It takes 72 hours if you want to include some of the medical facilities. It takes longer than that if you want to include absolutely everyone, because there's no way in or out of New Orleans except over a body of water. It's very limited into how you can get in and out. And if you did that every time a storm could come 4 days before you knew where the storm was going to hit, you're talking about a terrific expense. Who's going to pay that expense? New Orleans is a poor city in terms of its income from tax revenue and so forth. There's no way it could afford that. Would the state pay that? Would the federal government pay that? Who would pay to do it? Because you would have to do it more than one time. You would have to do it every time a storm was within 4 days of a possible landfall.
And see, that's what I just have a hard time imagining any government at any level would decide to do. And so... You know, in the aftermath of this, I think a lot of people scratching their heads and wondering, you know, the initial questions were, you know, why did this happen? Why did God let this happen? We talked a lot about that. And then how do we as Christians think about how to respond? I think, Dr. Kelly, one of the big questions on the part of a lot of Americans is, what makes New Orleans different? Not the geography. We've dealt with that. The topography. That's a factor of nature. But just in terms of the inhabitants of the city, what makes New Orleans different?
It is a very different culture. It is a blend of several European cultures, along with the Native Americans of that area, the Cajun culture, along with the classic North American culture, and the result is a melting pot unlike any other in the United States. It's a real laid-back kind of attitude. It is called the Big Easy. Everybody's ready for a party, and it's just a very different kind of detached from concern environment.
Yeah, I think a lot of this pathology is going to come to the American mind. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some statistics to kind of help us to get a handle on why New Orleans is different. And well, let's just say I think there's a very real hope on the part of Christians in New Orleans that there will be a different New Orleans in the future. Our phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Join the conversation and call us, and we'll be right back. The city of New Orleans has been a focus of the nation's attention before, but never like this. New Orleans has always been known to be in a very vulnerable geographic position. Any major hurricane coming through the Gulf has endangered New Orleans. It's a major port city. It's a major convention city. And perhaps you've been to that city in a trade show or like the Southern Baptist Convention has met there periodically and other major groups. But there's something about that culture that makes it just a little bit different. And as a Christian, I must say that there is a shadow over the city of New Orleans, a shadow of sin, because certainly you can find sin in any city, in every city. We are all sinners. Human depravity is a universal condition. But there are some cities that build their economy and their culture and their social structure around sin, and to a large degree, New Orleans has done that. Dr. Chuck Kelly, president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, you're a Christian leader right there in that city. That culture must present a real challenge.
It is a culture that feels hostile to evangelical Christians as soon as you get there. And it's very difficult to put into words, but every evangelical I know who comes, they get to New Orleans and they just feel like they're on enemy territory. And it's everything from knowing that on Halloween we'll have a long news story on the Wiccan community that's there, the roots of voodoo that go very deep, the blend of paganism with Christian symbols that's a part of the Mardi Gras tradition, the debauchery that's just a normal fact of life during that Mardi Gras time. It really is a culture hostile to evangelical Christianity.
I think one of the things that has always amazed me about New Orleans is that there are people on the streets all the time, 24 hours a day. You know, what explains that?
The fact that we love to have fun. We love to party. We love to play. And that's literally the attitude of New Orleans. Any excuse, you never know when you're going to be driving along and there'll be a spontaneous parade that just broke out. We have parades in conjunction with funerals. A jazz funeral has a brass band that leads the procession of the casket. And it is always ready for the party at the drop of a hat.
Well, it's always ready for something else, too. You know, long before Hurricane Katrina hit, New Orleans was really struggling with a crime problem. And I want to read to you from some FBI statistics. In the year 2003, the FBI reported murders per 1,000 persons. New York City, 5.2. L.A., 8.7. Washington, D.C., which has a notoriously high murder rate, 9.1. And New Orleans, 25.5. The previous year, in 2002, New Orleans reported 53.7. That is a multiple. I read just the other day that there are more unsolved crimes in New Orleans than solved crimes. That must be a part of this challenge as well.
It really is. Most of those murders take place in the same areas of the city. They're in the housing projects in the same area. They're overwhelmingly related to the drug trade, which is very strong in the city of New Orleans. And it really is a culture of violence that's deeply rooted as a part of the drug community in New Orleans.
Now, a lot of Americans know New Orleans as a city through the French Quarter, its most famous neighborhood, and then there's the Garden District, and I've even been with you in some of the wonderful restaurants there in that area. But tell us about the Ninth Ward.
The Ninth Ward is an old neighborhood in New Orleans that is mostly blue-collar and poorer people, and it has been famous for a lot of reasons, but it's primarily probably the most famous poor to blue-collar neighborhood in the city. It's that combination of the working poor and the impoverished poor.
Chuck, do you have any idea that in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, there is anything like an openness to the gospel on the part of the people who are going to be coming back into that city?
Oh, I think so. As a matter of fact, I think this is one of the ways that God is going to redeem. If ever there was a time for a message of hope, it is now. The task we face in New Orleans is not just rebuilding church buildings. It's literally replanting the church. A lot of that will be with people who have never been to New Orleans before. I think we're going to see a lot of people not come back, but we're going to see a lot of new people come in because there are going to be so many jobs and things to do to rebuild the city. So to me, it's a very exciting time to think about bringing the gospel to bear, and churches will have an unprecedented opportunity, I think, as a result of the tragedy.
Now, when you think of your faculty and students coming back, what do you want to see them doing there in the city of New Orleans?
We're going to be the backbone of what Southern Baptists are doing to help bring that city back. It's going to be being active in the local churches and the neighborhoods. I'm sure there'll be many projects going on. The scale is very difficult to describe. They will probably bulldoze tens of thousands of homes that they'll just be knocking down. How are they going to replace those? They do not know yet when they're going to have drinkable water in the city of New Orleans or sewage. And it's just a building project on a scale we've never seen before. So we want to be in the middle of that, working with the workers as well as working with the churches to collect their congregations again, but more importantly, to evangelize the new people who are coming in.
Now, let's expand it from New Orleans to the entire Gulf Coast and the affected areas. I have read the numbers in excess of 1,000 churches in Mississippi seriously affected by the storm, and hundreds that may literally have almost disappeared.
If it was within four blocks of the Gulf along the Mississippi Gulf Coast, it's gone, swept clean like a broom. There were 925 Southern Baptist churches alone, plus you throw in churches of other denominations and faiths. It is a huge project. From New Orleans to the city of Mobile, about a 200-mile stretch, just pretty much wiped out.
Well, isn't this, in a very strange and wonderful way, a great time to be a Christian in those areas?
Never before has the body of Christ been able to be present at the formation of a city. And literally, that's what's going to happen. There will be a new New Orleans. And now we have a much louder voice than evangelical Christians have had through the entire history of New Orleans. So it's a very exciting time to be a part of the new character and the new shape of a major urban area in our nation and the world.
Now, in the next several weeks, you're going to have people returning. You're going to have students coming back. Tell us about rebuilding your own campus. What are you going to be doing there?
It's going to take us about $20 million. It will take us probably about 6 to 8 months to finish everything. We hope to have some basic stuff done by January, and we hope to be pretty much back to normal by August. It'll be a very extensive project.
And you are up and running. You've got classes on the Internet and through your extension programs, and you're also in touch with your students.
That's correct. We've made contact with now 80% of our students that registered in August, tracking them down one by one and keeping things going. Why let a little thing like a Category 5 storm keep us from doing what God gave us to do?
Well, that is the indomitable spirit that I know in you, my friend Chuck Kelly, the president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. It's been an honor to have you on the program here today.
Thank you, Dr. Mulder.
And there have been Christians all over America who have been praying for you and your students and your faculty, and we've blogged about it and talked about it here on the program. Tell folks how they can get in touch with you.
They can get in touch by writing New Orleans Baptist Seminary, P.O. Box 1608, Decatur, Georgia, 30031.
And that's their temporary headquarters
in the
Atlanta area. Yes. And tell us about your website.
Website, nobts.edu.
There you have it. We'll be giving you updates from time to time about the progress in New Orleans and on that seminary campus. We're all a part of the body of Christ. This is not only their story, it's our story too. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mulder Program. Welcome back. You know, there are some Christians out there wondering if this is really our responsibility. We need to remember the biblical injunction to seek the welfare of the city. That city specifically was Jerusalem. But we need to seek the welfare of the city where we live, and we need to seek the welfare of all the cities where there are persons for whom Christ died. We need to see New Orleans not only as a real social challenge, a political and economic challenge. We need to see New Orleans, the city, as a spiritual challenge. We need to be reminded that the Lord Jesus Christ, when asked by a lawyer of the greatest commandment, said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." Jesus said, "This is the first and foremost commandment." But immediately thereafter, he said, "The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. Loving our neighbor as ourselves, that's quite a challenge. But it means not only the neighbor we can see, but also the neighbors all around us. We are part of a commonwealth, of a nation. We bear responsibility to seek the welfare of the city, of the nation, of the community. And right now we have a part of America, a very important part, a very strategic part. Millions of people in that entire affected area ought to be our concern. We need to seek their welfare. That means that Christians need to be on the forefront, not only of disaster relief, but also efforts to rebuild a civilization. We're the people who know why it matters. We understand why law is important. We understand why order and structure are necessary for human happiness and human good. We're the people there to give a glass of cold water. We need to be the people there to clothe those who need clothing and to give a bed for those who need rest. And, of course, we need to be there with the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Our credibility as Christians often comes down to the fact that we're not only there, but we're there for the right reason, we're there with the right heart, and we're there with the right message. We need to be praying that as institutions like New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary get back on their feet and the faculty and students come back, that they would be imbued with a kind of passion to reach persons who right now are asking some of the most fundamental questions of life. And this is why we need to organize Christians to be those who will take the gospel and will go to do good work in these communities. Because over the next several months, America and the world will be watching to see what happens. Christians are the ones who know why it's important that we do this. It's because we love God, and because we love God, we love our neighbor. And this means that we need to be there when our neighbor needs us. And New Orleans, the city, needs us. And, you know, we need the city of New Orleans. It'd be very easy for a lot of people to say, look, that city has an evil reputation. It's in a very vulnerable geographic location. Let's just let it go. Folks, this nation's not going to let it go. We need to make sure that the people who go there with the gospel. The great, great hope is that out of this disaster will arise a new city of New Orleans. And if it really is a different city of New Orleans, in that difference will be found the glory of God. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.